rebuttal. You may proceed, Mr. Belbrand.
Good morning.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Dennis Milbrath. I'm an attorney with Levy & Levy, SC in Cedarburg. We represent Mary Jones, the plaintiff appellant. This case is really quite simple. The record is simpler yet. The history is that in 1978, Mary Jones and her husband, strike that, and her fiancé, Robert Jones, entered a marital property agreement. They married in 1979. In 1998, Mary Jones conveyed the homestead of the parties to her stepsons, Robert and Lance Jones. She had previously received the property from her husband, Robert Jones. At that time, the property was the individual property of Robert Jones, and he transferred it to Mary as his individual property, and she kept it that way. Robert Jones died in 1999. The record really consists of the 1978 marital property agreement, which was amended several times, and the 1998 deed from Mary Jones to her stepsons. In 1999, Mary Jones sought to invalidate the deed because Robert Jones had not signed it. That was a violation of the statute of fraud. Judge Murphy ruled that as a matter of law, the deed was valid. Now, he ruled as a matter of law based upon the deed, the marital property agreement, and the statutes. I think Judge Murphy misconstrued 766.605 of the statutes.
Counsel, let me ask you, in that transfer that you are talking about, when the both parties were there, when I say the both parties, the husband, Mary, and the now deceased, the wife, rather, was there, and the husband was there, and she signed off in his presence, right?
That's not in the record.
That's not in the record?
That's not in the record.
Okay. So what we have here is there was a marital property agreement, and do you take the position that this was outside of that marital property agreement? What is? In other words, there was a marital property agreement. There were several amendments. The marital property agreement, just following the history of this, we had this conveyance. We had the first it was conveyed to her, and then she conveyed it to the two stepsons, correct?
Correct.
And that was done over a period of time, but the last one you indicated was 1998.
Right. September 16th, 1998.
And who, and what you're saying, we do not know from the record who was there at that?
No, we really don't. There are some affidavits that were put into the record.
Well, that's what I'm referring to.
Okay. Those affidavits, I brought a motion to strike those affidavits, and Judge Murphy determined that he wasn't going to rule on my motion. He held my motion moot because he was going to make his decision based solely upon the deed, the marital property agreement, and the statutes. Now, if you read those affidavits would say that in fact, Mary and Robert were there at the same time. But I don't think it's part of the record as the case is sitting here.
Oh, would it matter?
Today. No, I don't think it would.
Doesn't. He didn't sign it. The statute says you're going to transfer homestead. Husband and wife have to sign the conveyance or sign some indication that they're going along with it. They're both
Correct.
Going along with it. Okay. Now, you are at what part of 766 you think the trial judge misread?
Well, the trial judge, I think, misread 766.605. Now, he doesn't refer to 766.605 in his decision, but when you read his decision, he's paraphrasing it. And 766.605 says that when there's a jointly held homestead, and there's no indication in a marital property agreement or on the conveyance document as to how that property is held, it's survivorship marital property. Judge Murphy then determined that if it was individual property that the parties had, it couldn't have been homestead property. And if it wasn't homestead property, the statute of frauds, 706.02, is inapplicable. So I think what he did was he read 766.605 wrong and determined that because the property was individual, somehow that took it out of homestead.
Well, the property was deeded to Mr. Jones when they bought the property.
Correct.
When he bought the property.
Correct.
His name only.
Correct.
So what does 766.605 have to do with it? Because it wasn't acquired by the two parties.
I don't think it has anything to do with it.
Okay. What does the marital property statute have anything to do with this case?
It doesn't have anything to do with it. We never raised the marital property statute below.
All right.
The marital property statute was brought in, I think, by Judge Murphy in his decision in December, and the Court of Appeals picked up on it. I don't think it has anything to do with it.
Well, then, counsel, my recollection of his decision was that he distanced himself. He did not rely upon Chapter 766. Am I incorrect or correct on that?
I believe you're incorrect. He relied upon 766 to determine that the property was not homestead property, and because it wasn't homestead property, he decided that 704.02, the statute of frauds, was inapplicable to the case.
Well, what statutes did he rely on in his analysis? He looked at the agreement.
Correct.
The marital property agreement. He looked at the conveyance document.
Correct.
What specific statutes was he relying on in reaching his conclusions?
Specific, I can't tell you. He refers to 766, Chapter 766 in his decision. If you read the portion of his decision I am referring to, the only place you can really pick that up is 766.605. I thought that's what he was referring to. I brought a motion to reconsider explaining that I thought he had misinterpreted 766.605, and Judge Murphy denied my motion to reconsider without a decision, without any explanation.
Mr. Milbrath, yes. What is shown by the deeds themselves? Do the deeds refer to this property as homestead property?
Both deeds stated as homestead property.
Is that significant to your argument?
I think it is. Nobody disputes that this was homestead property. Nobody disputes that this was the residence of Mary Jones. It was the residence of Robert Jones. It was more than a quarter acre. It was less than 40 acres. Nobody disputes that. But the deed saying it's homestead property is significant because the statute of frauds doesn't only protect the parties to the transaction. It protects third parties. Third parties are allowed to go to the Register of Deeds and look at documents and determine, is there a cloud on this title? If they see that it's homestead property, and in other parts of the county records or the state records, they see that Mary Jones is married or Robert Jones is married, that creates a problem unless they can satisfy themselves that the homestead requirements have been met, that it's been waived.
What about the fact that you had both of these deeds executed the same day, first from Robert to his wife and then from her to the two stepsons? Is that not significant?
No.
Why?
No. It's not significant because the statute requires that the parties sign the document. Mr. Jones didn't sign the document. We don't know why he didn't sign the document. We know that he didn't sign the document. Now, there's a lot of cases that deal with what some would say is a ministerial act or just a non-important act that the case turns on. Serving an unauthenticated copy of a summons and complaint can cause problems. The statute of limitations can be missed by it. An attorney rubber stamping his name on a document, on a pleading, can invalidate it. Somebody who's not licensed in the state of Wisconsin but signs the pleadings on behalf of an attorney who is licensed, that's a recent case here, that causes the documents to be invalid. So the fact that Robert Jones didn't sign the deed is important. Why he didn't sign it, we don't know.
Counsel,
why he didn't sign it, we'll never know.
Let me ask you a question, because this, my previous, we were talking about, you mentioned in 1978 there was a premarital agreement.
Right.
And just going to that agreement in itself, didn't that agreement explicitly grant the right to unilaterally convey real property? Is that right or wrong? Have I misconstrued something? That's what I was, and that's significant when you answered Justice Crooks's question as far as he's asking, well, these were signed simultaneously, and that's why I asked about the premarital agreement.
The premarital agreement and all of its amendments, you will not find the word homestead in it, and you will not find homestead rights, you will not find homestead interests. It's not in there. The other cases that have been cited primarily by the Court of Appeals with its certification petition all deal with homestead being in there or not transferring of real estate that affects third parties. We don't know what was intended by the language that's in the marital property agreement, what Mr. Jones intended when he wrote that agreement. We do know that Wisconsin has a 113-year history of holding the homestead almost inviolate. If you don't comply with the requirements, it's too bad. Now, just because application of the law may cause a harsh and unfair, or even what some would say is a grossly unfair result, doesn't mean that public policy should be changed because of that. Wisconsin has a bright line when it comes to transferring the homestead or a conveyance of the homestead. A mortgage is a conveyance of the homestead. And that bright line is that if both parties don't sign, the transfer isn't valid. The conveyance isn't valid.
You're saying no matter what any other agreement may say or the premarital.
I'm saying that, yes, that as a matter of public policy, Wisconsin should continue that. I'm also saying that in this particular case, we don't have the homestead in the agreement.
Well, counsel, would it make a difference in this case if you did have the words homestead property and it was specifically waived by Mary Ann in 1978?
It might. But again, as a matter...
Isn't that this case? I mean, isn't the case really whether or not you can waive your homestead rights by a premarital agreement?
That may be the case, but it's not this case.
I know, but I'm asking you if she had signed it, and it said homestead, and she specifically waived her rights to homestead, what I'm getting at is how inviolate are premarital agreements, which I think this case is all about.
We have to then look at the statute of frauds, which is to protect third parties also. 766.56, I think it's 562A, I'm not certain, says that prenuptial agreements shouldn't be recorded, and if they are recorded, that they are not actual notice or constructive notice to third parties. So if we have the prenuptial agreement, let's say it said homestead rights, and let's say that they took it over to the Sheboygan Register of Deeds and filed it. A third party going and looking at that document isn't allowed to rely on that document. And there's a good reason why they're not allowed to rely on that document. That document might be struck down later as invalid for various reasons. That document may be ambiguous. There's reasons why you shouldn't be able to rely on a written document. There may be a subsequent marital property agreement entered into between Mary and Robert Jones, and that agreement isn't recorded. So people who to protect the sanctity, if you will, of the recorded documents, people should be able to go to the Register of Deeds, look at it, and know, is there a cloud on this title?
Well, but if I had examined this record, I would have said, oh dear, it was homestead property. Query whether it changed its, I don't know how it could have changed its nature in the same day. And I would have gotten a quick claim deed from Mr. Jones if I were the third party, or if he's deceased, I check the probate record to see if any claim has been made by his estate on this. And if the probate was all closed, that would be fine. I would approve it, or I'd get title insurance. And it seems to me that after the probate, it'd be a very low risk. So third parties can protect themselves here. What case do you have where a person who signs the deed then wants to upset the deed because what your client is doing, in effect, is claiming his homestead right, right? Not hers, but she signed off. She gave a warranty deed. Is she liable to be sued then for breach of warranty if you should win?
I don't know that. I don't know why warranty deeds were used.
I know, but they were used. So she's liable on a, potentially liable on a warranty deed.
Potentially, I suppose.
Potentially. Mm-hmm.
The only case where, well, actually there are two cases where the statute of frauds, if you will, was used as a sword.
Right.
One of the cases is Galinsky v. Sheldon. That's the case that the State Bank of Drummond case relied upon. And in Galinsky, the husband had executed sale documents of the home. The wife did not want to convey the home. The purchaser, Galinsky, sued Sheldon for specific performance. Initially, they only named the husband as the defendant. The husband demurred. He said, I can't convey because my wife won't sign it. That was the theory of the case. He was going to use the statute of frauds as a sword. The case was amended, and they sued both husband and wife, but the theory of the case remained the same. Husband and wife used the statute of frauds as a sword. And the court of strike that the Supreme Court said, that's fine. The other case is Weber v. Weber.
But of course, the Supreme Court said that he might be liable for misrepresenting his wife's intent.
Sure.
Right? That's why I raised the issue of the warranty deed. That would make these two the same. Comparable.
And the same holds true in the State Bank of Drummond case. The wife in that case put $4,000 in her pocket and maybe defrauded the bank. The Supreme Court said there may be an action against the wife in that case. But as far as the deed goes, the court said that the deed was invalid.
Yeah, but there the husband may have also been defrauded because he didn't get any of the money.
He may have been. The court really struggled with coming up with a good, equitable result in that case, and that case was littered with a lot of problems with attorneys having conflicting roles also. It was a difficult case.
Could I go back to the question of a premarital agreement? Is it your position that a premarital agreement cannot take the homestead property out of its status as homestead and keep it as individual property?
No, I'm not saying that it can't change it. Perhaps a properly drafted marital property agreement could.
But it seems to me, though, that you've argued in your brief that each spouse has an absolute veto power over the transfer of the property.
That's correct.
So that if after there's a clear-cut, beautifully drafted marital agreement, Subsequently, a spouse could simply refuse to sign a conveyance and completely undo the agreement, according to your theory.
No, because if there was a properly drafted agreement, the spouse who didn't want to transfer, strike that, the spouse who wanted to transfer could go to court and seek to enforce the contract between the parties.
Well, isn't that what this case is? I mean, it's not postured that way, but that's what this case really is. That is that the estate here, the two co-personal representatives, are saying we want to enforce the prenuptial agreement.
No, because this case doesn't have the properly drafted premarital agreement.
Okay. Your position then is maybe another one, but not this one. And it's not this one, if I understand your argument, because it never mentions the word homestead.
It doesn't mention the word homestead, and one could read the language that is referred to by the Court of Appeals, individual rights with the ability to transfer, and different minds could read it differently. A third party reading that could come up with a different conclusion, whether or not the homestead. The other reason is, and I think it's the policy reason, this court should say that both parties must sign the deed, whether or not if there, it's in the premarital agreement. If it requires the transferring spouse taking the other spouse to court to get a specific performance of the marital property agreement, so be it. But the statute of frauds should allow people to go to the Register of Deeds, look at the documents, and know whether or not there's a cloud on the title.
So
it's
that
not
means,
difficult.
Excuse me, so that means if you have a 500-acre farm and there's a marital property agreement, it's okay to sign off 499 acres. I'm talking about, but the homestead is sacrosanct, and that has to be signed off by both parties. Does that make a lot of sense from a
it does.
Yeah.
For 113 years.
Yeah, that's what you're saying.
It does.
Mr. Milbrath, this was a second marriage for the Jones, or at least for Mr. Jones.
Yes, for both of them.
And he owned a particular house that they later lived in and sold.
Correct.
I assume that if you win this case, Mrs. Jones will get that homestead property free and clear and will have no obligation whatsoever to convey that or leave it to Mr. Jones' son.
Correct.
Isn't that completely contrary to what Mr. Jones wanted?
We don't know. We don't know what Mr. Jones wanted on September 16th of 1998. And if this case is remanded to see whether or not equitable reformation should be used, it becomes even more difficult because then we're talking about what Mr. Jones intended when he signed the premarital agreement back in 1978. Did he intend to give up the homestead rights? Because that cuts both ways. During the time of their marriage, Mary Jones perhaps could have purchased a homestead and owned the homestead. And maybe Mr. Jones didn't want her to be able to convey the homestead away from him. The agreement doesn't say homestead, and we don't know whether or not Mr. Jones intended homestead to be included. Now, a properly drafted marital property agreement might be an entirely different matter.
Well, the statute talks about some things that cannot be in a marital property agreement. For example, you can't simply have an agreement to eliminate child support.
Correct.
There's nothing in the statute that talks about eliminating homestead, is there?
Not that I know of.
And isn't there language in the marital agreement that's broad enough to cover homestead?
There's language in the marital property agreement that's broad enough to cover homestead in one person's interpretation. Perhaps another person, a different person, would have a different interpretation of what was intended.
Well, in this case, counsel, it seems pretty clear to me from the facts, but you may say that I'm wrong, that Mary Ann Jones clearly intended to convey this property to the two stepsons. And now she's taking advantage of a law that essentially turns that intent on her head. She says, well, no matter what I intended, the law says that my husband's name had to be on there also. I don't find that a very equitable argument.
Again, I'll go back to what I said about harsh results. There, as you can surmise, there's a lot going on here. Okay. There's a lot not in the record. And
the rest of the story.
The rest of the story. And if this court is going to change the law, it should be changed on a different case on better facts. Homestead isn't in this one.
Counsel, let me just, I know your red light is on. You keep saying that this premarital agreement is subject to various interpretations. Now, ordinarily, interpretation of a written document is a question of law that we can decide. Just read the materials. But if there's additional material that a court should know about, you bring it in evidence. And this has not been done. Is it your position you want this to go back and have evidence taken on the intent in 1978 and then the intent in the year in which these deeds were made up?
Is absolutely
that your position?
Not.
You don't want that?
No.
Okay.
You
want it, just look. The rest of the story is not before us. You don't want it before us. We just look at the words on the sheets of paper.
I'm saying that as a matter of public policy, this court should look at the deed and continue the 113-year history that the statute of frauds has set down.
Okay, thank you, counsel. You have five.
I'm sorry. I'll wait till.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Before you begin, Mr. Halverson, let me greet some people in the audience, if we can. We have Mark Shanebaum's class from Appleton North High School. Would they stand, please? We have some in the jury box, and we have some behind us. Well, we appreciate your coming, and are you the teacher,
yes,
sir?
Yes, I am. And I also have with me Kurt Salt, and he has some students for his AP politics class, and they're here from two high schools, North and Xavier. Maybe they want to stand up also.
Well, thank you, and would those students please stand? Very good. Thank you for bringing the class, and we hope that you will find this instructive. Please be seated. And we also have with us a very faithful County Board supervisor who was here yesterday at our press conference and asked some very good questions, Lloyd Clean, who is the chair of the Law Enforcement Committee. And Mrs. Clean, won't you stand, please? Thank you. And we thank the Board of Supervisors for the wonderful building in which this court sits and all of the support that the County Board gives to the Outagamie County Court, the judges, and the staff thereof, as well as the important Law Enforcement Committee, and supported also by the Fox Valley Technical College, as you very well know, Lloyd. We also have Lawrence University students with us today. Would they stand?
They're behind us.
Good. I don't mean to cover you. What class are you with? Or are you just independent?
Constitutional
law. Very good. Thank you very much for coming to Lawrence University, and we're going to be having lunch tomorrow at Lawrence University and hope to meet you all again and others. That was a break to give you a little time, Mr. Halverson.
Thank you.
And
my time, or can I take it
down? Mr. Halverson representing Lane Jones and
Lance
Robert
Jones, Your Honor.
Pardon me?
Lance Jones.
Lance, sorry.
Lance and Robert are the sons of the deceased Robert G. Jones, and I do, in fact, represent them, the defendants and respondents in this matter. I've heard the questions. I don't know where to begin trying to anticipate what questions are going to be thrown my way. But a question was raised by Justice Wilcox, particularly about the significance of these documents, these deeds, which are in the record in various places. And it's not as if these deeds were executed in a vacuum. These deeds were executed on the same date. The facts will show simultaneously, and were signed in the correct order to transfer the interests that the parties obviously intended. The documents were then recorded in a proper sequence in the office of the Register of Deeds for Sheboygan County. If you look at the documents, you'll note that the first deed, the warranty deed from Robert G. Jones, is stated to be as individual property, which is consistent with the prenuptial, premarital agreement and contemplation of marriage, whichever designation you want to utilize. But that was consistent in this relationship. Mr. Jones came into this relationship as a man who was a widower with two adult children. He had a marital residence from his prior marriage that he wanted to see go on to his adult sons.
Mr. Halverson, isn't it also correct, though, that both of those deeds call this homestead property?
Correct. I think that that's one of the problems that we have as lawyers drafting this sort of a document, because, in fact, it has a double entry, a double meaning. You'd be incorrect if you said it wasn't homestead property, because they live in it. The statute defines homestead as a dwelling. But between the two parties, what is the significance of this designation on the deed? I question that. It's required when we come in and record it. We give the notice here of the fact that this is individual property being conveyed to Mary Ann Jones. It is homestead property. The subsequent deed for Mary Ann Jones to the boys, in fact, refers to it once again as homestead property, but again contains that qualification. The grantor, Mary Ann Jones, reserves the right to reside in the residence for the life of Robert Jones. As Justice Abramson indicated, if she was checking the title to this, this may present a question for a third party that maybe they better address before they go down the line.
Well, that second deed is the one that's really significant, is it not? Because the statute doesn't make any exception for having the other spouse sign if it's homestead property. How do you get around that?
Are both deeds void then? That's my concern. Maybe if one is void, isn't the other void? Aren't we back in the estate? Determining what was intended by the marital deed.
Isn't there an exception in the statute when you're conveying from one spouse to the other?
I don't know of an exception.
Okay. But in the second deed, clearly you've got a conveyance going to two other parties. You're calling it homestead property, and yet the other spouse is not signed, as the statute requires without exception. How do you get around that?
Difficult. Obviously, that's one of the problems that exists in this case that the trial court dealt with and that we dealt with. Technically, there is no way around it. That may be true, but that's what I say. Then both of the documents may be meaningless.
Well, 706021F says it has to be signed except conveyances between spouses. So that may very well cover that first one, although in the old days when I drafted these documents, we would have said Robert Jones, a married man, to Mary Ann Jones, his wife. That would have told everybody that was an okay document. Then drafting the second document would have been a little trickier.
Well, that's the problem we have is obviously the interpretation of the language in the prenuptial agreement or the premarital agreement. And this goes back to 78, I believe, which was in the infancy of marital agreements. As we all know, there was a time when they weren't even recognized in Wisconsin, and we were phasing into that time when this document was drafted. The parties later agreed to opt into marital property law.
Counsel, how do you respond, though, to the chief's suggestion, which I think is more than a suggestion, it's a reading of the statute, 706.02 sub F. Your argument, in part, rests on, look, if the second one was improper, the first one was also improper or invalid because it didn't have both signatures. But as I read 706.02 sub F, there is an exception, except conveyances between spouses. Doesn't that undercut your argument?
Possibly, you're right. The fact that on the deed itself, it doesn't say Robert G. Jones to Mary Ann Jones, my wife. You would still have to go outside the document to supply something that's needed to correct the record if you were concerned with whether there was a reserved homestead right. But when she is conveyed away and reserved to herself, she's changed the complexion of the normal homestead law. At the end, after that deed has been on record for 1 year, she no longer has a homestead interest in that property because she's given it away. We've got to remember we had a couple here that married at a time when they were interested in preserving. At least Mr. Jones was interested in preserving a portion of his estate to pass on to his adult children. By the language in the premarital agreement, he thought he had done that. Understanding that's the environment in which these documents were executed. Now, with the benefit of hindsight, we're going back and we're fine-tuning it and looking at it with a magnifying glass and saying what we should have done is that Robert Jones should have changed the language somewhat here. He thought he was conveying his individual property in its entirety.
But isn't that the point of your opposing counsel, that maybe in the future the word homestead should be in these agreements, but it wasn't here, and therefore we shouldn't do anything about it, even though there may be equities on your side? But that's the...
We're back to the sword and the shield,
yes,
argument. And this is what the case of Drummond was all about, as I read it, was that we had a bad scene, we're going to correct it. We're not going to let her get away with this. In most of these cases that have dealt with that subject, that was, and even the Drummond case, talked about the reason for this harsh rule was to avoid this sort of fraud being committed upon one of the spouses. We don't have that situation here. We have the spouse, the surviving spouse, after the decedent is dead and buried, saying, hey, set it aside. Now, this is my property. I didn't mean that.
So you want equitable reformation?
That's correct.
Okay. Counsel, what does the marital property law have to do with this case, if anything?
Well, we have marital property law and we have real estate property law in Wisconsin, and it would be ideal in this case, as well as in every case that we deal with, if they were always totally compatible and intertwined. The law doesn't always work that way. We all know that. And that's one of the problems that we, as lawyers, face every day trying to draft these documents. If I were to go back and second-guess the lawyer who drafted this one, when the marital property law became effective in 86, it probably should have been readdressed and gone back in greater detail. Maybe it wouldn't have even been caught then, because this is a narrow technical area where we're using this reference to homestead. And the description in the marital property agreement, what the parties intended, is very clear.
Well, of course, it's very difficult to go back because maybe the parties agreed on property when they before they got married, but after 10 years or more of marriage, they may no longer agree on the property, so you may not want to open up that can of worms.
Well, that marital property agreement very definitively set forth the homestead of Mr. Jones, his premarital homestead. And that property was owned for 10 years or so after the parties were married. And when it was sold, Mr. Jones sold it as his individual property.
Did she sign that deed?
I don't have that. As I'm going through this, I'm thinking, I wish I had that deed in front of me right now.
Is it in the record or don't you remember?
I don't recall. She may have joined in it for that purpose. He acquired with the proceeds a new property, which became this 520 Woodlake Road property where the home was built. It was purchased in his name, once again, his individual property. He did all of the construction and the costs incidental to it and maintained it, even though they continued to live in it. We were presented with a situation where in the second marriage situations, can somebody coming into the marriage with a home of substantial value, now remarrying, can he shield that from the new wife? And in order to do so, what does he have to specifically do? State in some document, this is homestead? Or is it sufficient to say all real estate now owned?
Do you understand your opposing counsel's argument to be that even if it's validly stated and homestead is mentioned 15 times, so there's no doubt that you're referring to the homestead property, even in that instance, it runs afoul of the statute of frauds, doesn't it?
That's correct. I think that's it. That's his argument.
And that if she were not, let's say it's his property in my hypothetical, as well as this case, and if she were not willing to sign in any deed, even though the property agreement, marital property agreement, had specifically made reference to homestead, he would have to take her to court to get her to do that. Is that?
I agree. Mm-hmm. I think that's what the status would be. It's a harsh situation, and it makes these premarital agreements even more in jeopardy.
Well, my concern is with the second marriages, this kind of thing happens with, this is part of the daily fare for those who engage in estate planning, keeping the property of, in this instance, the husband, to pass on to the children, but let the wife live in it for a year or two after he dies. I mean, that's pretty common.
I can only state from my own experience that I haven't seen one of those documents that specifically refers to homestead. The more appropriate or the more common way is to refer to it by address or property subsequently purchased with the proceeds from the sale of that first property. But I've not seen that word homestead carried into the document as such.
So in his, say it's his property, in his estate planning document, he doesn't have the right to convey their homestead. Let's say he died. He doesn't have the right to convey that homestead property even upon death? Is that the logical extension of your opponent's argument?
That's my understanding of it, yes. In other words, I could not buy this prenuptial agreement without her cooperation, shelter it.
Let's say he died, and he intended then that after his death, the property goes to the kids, but she can live in the house for a year or two.
Yeah.
What do you understand your opposing counsel's argument to be? You know, all of a sudden, there she is. He's died. She doesn't have a lot of money of her own. She has this beautiful house on the lake.
that's now going to go to the kids in 1 year or 2 years, and she doesn't want that, you know? So what happens, as your understanding, response to your opposing
what
counsel?
Happened in this case. The heirs abided by the terms of the agreement, paid her according to the agreement what she was supposed to receive and expected she would vacate at the end of that year. But in the within 3 months of the date of death, she filed the response in this action and commenced a separate action and said, no, I'm not abiding by that. That deed was void. The deed I gave to the boys, consistent with the premarital agreement, is void because Bob didn't join with me in it.
Mr. Halverson, did Judge Murphy ever decide the argument in regard to equitable reformation?
Yeah, he threw my argument into the proverbial trash bin.
He said it was...
Maybe appropriately. I'm not here to argue that, but I had an argument in that direction, which the Court of Appeals has given some pre-indication. Maybe they didn't appreciate that either.
Well,
but you're still standing by that argument, yes.
I still think this is... We're dealing with equity throughout, and reformation is a historically recognized doctrine to be used in these cases. To after the man is in his grave, to say, that's all out. And because technically he didn't sign this document, it's void.
Is the record sufficient here at this point to allow for equitable reformation? In other words, did you make a sufficient record at the trial court level in regard to your argument of equitable reformation?
Excuse me, Justice.
Sure, no problem.
As you can tell from the record, and I think as Mr. Milbreath alluded to, Judge Murphy decided the case and sort of pushed it in a direction and said, okay, I'm going to decide this question as a matter of law. Submit your briefs to me. He reached the conclusion this was not homestead property. Therefore, he said he didn't have to rule on Mr. Milbreath's motion striking my arguments seeking reformation because it wasn't homestead property, so it was irrelevant.
But he did rule on it.
Yeah.
Would you have presented evidence on that argument? Did you want the opportunity for that?
Evidence in the form of affidavits documenting how these deeds were executed, when, where, and those sorts of things, that it was a part of an estate plan device and these sorts of things. Yeah, that was in my brief.
Counsel, I'm having a bit of trouble with the specificity of the language here. Are you saying that this is not homestead property? Okay.
It's the law doesn't seem to define any limitation on homestead. You're either in or you're out.
What did the trial court rule? Did the trial court rule that this was not homestead property?
That's correct.
Or did the trial court rule that this was homestead property but was waived?
No. He said it was not homestead property.
Why? Why was it not homestead property?
Because under the marital agreement, it was individual property.
Okay.
But he winds up, if you look at it, saying, in effect, it's homestead, but this contract eliminated her right to homestead.
That's correct. That's my understanding of it.
All right. Now, you know, one reason cases come to the Wisconsin Supreme Court is because, as both counsel here recognized, you have conflicting threads in the law, and they've got to be brought together. So you have the state statute on fraud. You got a prenuptial agreement, a contract. You've got several deeds here, and you have concepts of equity, right?
Yes.
So, if you were the justice, how would you write this opinion? And I'll ask you the same thing, counsel.
Excuse me.
Because we've got to make sense out of all of this. And when we draft the rule, it doesn't only cover Mrs. Jones and the two Jones sons. It covers everybody sitting in this room, potentially, as well as the entire state, and we've got to adhere to past law and adhere to the state statutes, right? So how do you write it, counsel?
Well, I didn't file another brief in this case. I'd filed enough before, I felt. I looked at the certification as it came to your court from the Court of Appeals, and I was impressed with the issues that they were raised and the arguments. And I think the three issues that they pointed out can be addressed. Can a spouse waive the homestead protection in a premarital agreement? I should surely hope that they can. If they can't, we're going to have to go back to the drawing board with the legislature, because a lot of us are assuming that to be the fact. May a spouse who has conveyed homestead property to a third party later invoke the statute of frauds as a sword to undo the conveyance because the other spouse did not join in the conveyance? I think that it would be grossly inequitable to answer that question and say that they could.
Well, we don't have to answer that question, do we?
If we answer
the first question.
And the language in the marital agreement covers, yes.
And then continue on.
Then does the ban against equitable reformation of a homestead conveyance by a spouse, as stated in the Bank of Drummond, apply where the conveyance is not the product of fraud, overreaching, etc.? That's the reason for the doctrine of Drummond, Bank of Drummond, as I see it. Whether this is a case of overreaching on the part of Mary, fraud or unscrupulous attempts, I don't know. This is all after the fact we're arguing this. But the language, the Bank of Drummond case, just saying this is not a case for reformation, I think is incorrect. Because here's the perfect case where the facts don't lend themselves to that kind of an interpretation.
Mr. Halverson, suppose the court bought Judge Murphy's analysis, but we had a fact situation in which the only asset was the house that Mrs. Jones is living in. No other assets were passed. Do you want us to buy into a position where we, in effect, put the widow out in the street?
Well, you're changing the fact situation on me to the point where you're saying this is the only asset, and if she agrees to it beforehand, arguably yes.
Well, maybe then you'd have a different case here, arguing that the premarital agreement is unconscionable and the court ought not to recognize it.
Possibly so. That situation isn't our case.
Is that in the record?
That it's not the case? I think the evidence in the case is sufficient to show that there are other assets that are being probated. This is where my argument was going and seeking reformation in my brief in the trial court because of the tax implications and what they were trying to accomplish.
Now, gift tax return was filed here. I didn't get a chance to look at it. Is that on this property?
It's my recollection. If I can look behind me, I can probably get an answer.
No, well, we can find it in the record. That's fine.
One of the attorneys who do that is in the back. I believe it was. I wasn't involved in that. Obviously, this was before I became involved in this case.
It'll be defined in the description of the property.
Yeah.
Thank you. Are there any other questions to counsel? Mr. Halverson?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Save some time for some other worthy fan. Does it carry over?
Next time we'll give you the extra. Thanks. Mr. Mobra.
Thank you. The question about
This agreement was entered into in 1978, and perhaps we weren't thinking of Homestead. It's an evolving area of law. Actually, in the Jones v. National Bank case, that's a 1949 Wisconsin Supreme Court case, that marital property agreement referred to homestead rights, and that was a 1939 prenuptial agreement. So I don't think that homestead is this new concept that people have just stumbled on. It is something, however, that is not in the 1978 agreement. It could have been. It's not.
Would you address just for a moment the equitable argument, if there is any, that what you feel that the court should do, if anything, about that?
I don't think the court should do anything. I think the court should continue the line of cases that say if it's homestead property, you better get both spouses' signatures. That's not difficult. It's not a burdensome statute. It's dealt with all the time. And if one of the parties won't sign, if we have the case where there is no marital property agreement, the non-signing spouse has an absolute veto, and there's no court action that can force that spouse to convey. If you have a properly drafted marital property agreement that says homestead interests or homestead, in that case, the spouse who doesn't want to convey can be forced to convey by a court. So we don't have to address the issue of equitable reformation when we have a marital property agreement if the marital property agreement is properly drafted. If we have a marital property agreement that's ambiguous or not properly drafted, then we shouldn't be going into equitable reformation, because where does it stop? This court has long held it stops. You don't even come to us if you want us to equitably reform a document, a homestead transaction that hasn't had both parties' signature.
Is there any case law support for the proposition that the signing spouse can invoke the statute of frauds to undo the transaction which he or she signed?
By implication, yes, there's two cases. There is Galinsky v. Sheldon, a 1979 case, which I earlier spoke about, and there's also Weber v. Weber. In Weber, it dealt with a mortgage. It wasn't a conveyance of title. It was a mortgage. But in that case, the husband and wife relied upon the wife's non-signing of the mortgage as the sword to knock down the conveyance. That was sent back to the trial court for a determination on whether or not there'd been part performance, because purchase money mortgage is an exception to the statute.
Right, but those involved mortgage situations where you had a third party, that is the bank holding the mortgage, making the argument.
Weber v. Weber dealt with a mortgage between related parties. It was the husband's parents, I believe. Galinsky was a sale case. That was a case where husband wanted to sell the property, and he had signed documents to sell the property, and the wife wouldn't convey. And he defended, in the first instance, the specific performance action by saying, my wife won't sign, and that's a defense for me. So he used the statute of frauds as a sword in that case.
How does your argument play out? Let's assume that there was no signing of deeds, that this was a marital property agreement and a will effectuating the marital property agreement signed by the parties. How does that play out then, if it's homestead property?
I haven't thought that one through. I don't think it affects it, though.
Well, I'm concerned about the ramifications of your argument, and I don't pretend to know the answer. That's why I asked the question. But I'm concerned that the extension of your argument is that he cannot convey homestead property even when he's alive and signing, or his estate cannot without her signature. That's what your argument's, the logical extension of your argument seems to be.
Well, he could convey while he's alive. He could have conveyed by just, if Mary wouldn't have signed the deed when they tried to convey, he could have brought an action to force her to convey.
One of my concerns is I hate to be endorsing a procedure that requires confrontation in court, fighting among families. I mean, you know, we try to keep things out of courts. It might sound odd since we are a court, but I don't want to be promoting a law that promotes confrontation between families upon death and require them to go to court.
And I've got a red light, but if I could answer.
You may, counsel.
And that's perhaps why this isn't the right case to decide about marital property agreements and homestead, because it's not in this case. And this case, I think, is really just a statute of frauds case, plain and simple, and equitable reformation.
So I gather the way you would write this opinion is to say, this is homestead property, everybody agrees about that, that the marital prenuptial agreement does not cover homestead because it doesn't say anything. Therefore, statute of fraud operates.
Correct.
And that's your way of writing it.
And it can be used as a sword, and as far as equitable reformation, I'd say we should continue the longstanding policy of this court.
Thank you, Mr. Mobrath. Thank you, Mr. Halverson, for a well-done oral argument and briefs on...